to us by recording from the Pacifica Station in Los Angeles, KPFK.
This is William O'Connell, and we're talking again about the Warren Commission report on the assassination of President Kennedy. I had recently Harold Weisberg in our studio, and we were talking about his book, Whitewash. Mr. Weisberg, as you may remember, is a newspaper and magazine writer, a former Senate investigator, and an intelligence and political analyst. And I wanted to have him back again today because he talked initially about Whitewash, his first book, and I asked him to go into great detail on one particular reconstruction of the Warren Commission with reference to Oswald and the depository. And we exhausted our time so quickly that I felt it was necessary that we address ourselves in a second program to his newer book, Whitewash 2. Welcome back again, Mr. Weisberg.
Glad to be here.
I wonder if we could start off by telling our radio audience in what particulars and in terms of its general thrust, how does Whitewash 2 differ from your first book?
Whitewash, the report on the Warren Report, the first book, was intended and I believe did prove that the Warren Report was a whitewash. Whitewash 2, which has the subtitle, The FBI Secret Service Cover-Up, is intended to show how the whitewashing was done and by whom. I believe it does this overwhelmingly, and although I am absolutely without doubt that Whitewash, the first book, utterly and completely destroyed the report, it is so overwhelming in the second book that there's been absolutely no denial, even when responsible elements of the press have questioned the government agencies involved about it.
Now, in the in the New York Review of Books, with reference to Whitewash 1, an article in there said that you had given perhaps, I believe, the closest analysis of the evidence contained in the 26 volumes. But I understand since then, and especially after reading Whitewash 2, that you have perhaps more than any other critic, I would say, of the case immersed yourself in the files of the National Archives, and it is largely from newly released files
right.
and documents that you have formed the basis for Whitewash 2.
That is correct. And if you'd like to know the extent of my immersion with my wife, I figured about 2 weeks ago when I was driving and had time to think that the two of us have a total of over 22,000 hours of work on this subject.
Could you tell us something about the National Archives themselves?
Yes, because
and how you go about your work there?
Generally misunderstood. Everybody has the idea that this is a great big conspiratorial thing and you got to sneak in the middle of the night and bribe people and all that sort of stuff, and it's utter nonsense. These are the most dedicated and responsible kind of public employees who are in charge of really our national heritage. All of the great documents of our history are stored there, and many, many of less importance that are important to individual people in various aspects of their interest and work. The archives are wide open. You can walk in, authenticate your needs and purposes, and use the facilities where there are classified files or where there are restricted files. Now, the archive that has been established on the assassination, and it's a shamefully inadequate thing, but aside from that, and of course this is not the fault of the people in the archives, the conditions are controlled from outside of the archive, and it's beyond their jurisdiction and competence to make decisions, but where they function impartially, they function honorably, they do not reveal the interest of one researcher to another or his discoveries. They're honorable people. And in order to have access to this archive, all you need to do is show that you're a qualified researcher or even just a newspaper man. Then you are given a card which identifies you. If you have to take equipment in, such as a typewriter, you get a property pass. There's no rigmarole about it at all. And there is I hate to call it a bibliography. In fact, I hate to call it anything. But what is pretended to be a list of what's in this file is available. And if you're enough of a genius and can understand the gobbledygook of the various agencies, especially the FBI, which has everything listed more or less as Oswald, communism, Cuba, sometimes they add Russia. And this is a description of perhaps a third to a, half of the documents, one way or another.
Now, you mentioned, Mr. Weisberg, that what is available to the archives, I think your phrase was, is not always controlled by them. I wonder what you meant specifically.
I mean by that the archivist himself has not made anything secret. What is denied researchers is denied by the executive agencies, mostly the FBI. By number, about a third of the files are secret. Now, since we can't see them, we don't know what they are by volume. The volume of the entire archive is approximately 300 cubic feet. Most of the CIA stuff is classified secret. If it was yesterday's unrefrigerated milk toast, it would still involve the national security. But mostly it's FBI stuff. However, I've had no difficulty at all in working there. They've been very cooperative, and nor have I had any difficulty in getting some of the most shocking, if not the very most shocking, documents in our history from these files. Now, the archives people are very cooperative. I didn't have to sneak them out or take a spy camera in. They made Xerox copies for me, 20 cents a copy. If I need an 8x10 print, the photography is $1.50 a piece. The prices are nominal. And they get it for you. This is their function. They're very responsible people. So I don't make any pretense of being James Bond. I'm an analyst. And the archivist and all the people under him are remarkably cooperative. And it is this from which my second book that I say shows an FBI Secret Service cover-up comes.
Now, to what degree does the material in the archive differ from what we have in the 26 volumes where certain FBI and Secret Service interrogations are printed in facsimile, in addition to the testimony given before the commission in toto and then commission counsel individually?
Sometimes they are identical. Sometimes you find by the commission's file number what you may recall having already seen printed as an exhibit. These are not correlated. And those who are familiar with the 26 volumes may waste a vast amount of time going over something that already exists in the printed books they may have bought. They are similar in nature, but very often entirely different in content.
But is there new material that
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and my whole new book comes from it. Now, I'd like to begin with some documents that show just how immature, just how self-serving much of it was. But in order to explain it and introduce it, I'd like to remind the listeners that I said that the purpose of Whitewash 2 is to show who did the whitewashing and how. Now, much of this is non-governmental. Without the lusty cooperation of the press, there could have been no whitewash. On the other hand, I think it's necessary to understand that there are many, many responsible journalists and papers, and that these people tried. They actually did what newspapers are supposed to do. One major newspaper spent more than a month with all the mail and power it could get. They could find nothing. Now, of course, when this happened, they were satisfied there was nothing to find, and this tended to credit the report that was subsequently issued. The truth of the matter is that everybody was foreclosed immediately by the FBI.
It's a totally
shocking thing. I'll give you an example that illustrates this. We have the question of the rifle. A rifle was found on the sixth floor of the depository building, and it had to be traced. The FBI was remarkably efficient. They located the source of that rifle in less than 24 hours. At Klein's, or at least the alleged source, I think we ought to say alleged about everything, because this thing is so obfuscated, so distorted, so misrepresented, so much evidence was destroyed, so much was ignored, that a reasonable man has to be suspicious of everything. But in any event, we assume that all the documents they have are authentic and mean exactly what meaning is given to them. And the FBI found that Klein's Sporting Goods in Chicago was the source of the rifle found on the sixth floor. The Secret Service separately was led to the same conclusion and to the same destination. And when the Chicago office of the Secret Service went to Klein's Sporting Goods, they couldn't get the time of day. Klein's wouldn't talk to them at all. They got there early in the morning of the next day, the 23rd of November. And it wasn't until 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon that one of the executives of Klein's broke down and said that the FBI told them to talk to nobody. And even then, they wouldn't talk to the Secret Service.
They would not talk to the Secret
Service?
No. The Secret Service approached them after the FBI.
Well, yes, but the Secret Service has spent more than half a day working on them, rather intensively, and couldn't get anything. And finally, I think it was Mr. Waldman, one of the executives, who had impressed upon him by the Secret Service what is true, that with the protection of the president, the Secret Service has priority. And they wanted his cooperation, and they finally got it. But all his cooperation could consist of was telling him what he gave the FBI.
I see.
Now, if the FBI could foreclose the Secret Service in an investigation of the assassination of an American president, I think it's quite comprehensible how a newspaper man who didn't have the powers of the federal agencies, of the police agencies, could have looked and looked and looked. Witnesses were told the same thing. People not connected with corporations. And I think it is for this reason, among others, that most of the competent newspapermen who tried so hard could find nothing.
When was the FBI charged by the president, President Johnson, that is, with the responsibility of conducting an investigation of the assassination?
There's common misunderstanding about that, but I'd like to take Mr. Hoover as my authority. And in Volume 5, on pages 98 and 99, he told the commission that as soon as he got back to Washington, almost within 24 hours, the president put the FBI in charge. I have this testimony of Mr. Hoover quoted verbatim in the last page of the main part of the text of Whitewash 2. It begins by Hoover saying, "When President Johnson returned to Washington, he communicated with me within the first 24 hours and asked this bureau to pick up the investigation of the assassination," and so forth.
Yes.
That's from page 223 of Whitewash 2. You understand, Mr. O'Connell, that my approach is unique. In both books, I depend upon the official information. Now, to give you an idea, as we began before, of the character of the investigation. You know, everybody thinks it's a come what may, swashbuckling right down the middle, deep searching, nothing's going to escape us bit. And the opposite is the truth. Because in order to condition the press, remember we've been talking about the press, because the press is very important in a society such as ours. And in incidents and crimes such as this, there was another technique used. The press was in effect corrupted. Each major element of the press had petty favors granted to it. You see, the commission's work was not done in public. It was all star chamber. There wasn't...
Well, I believe Mark Lane did have a public hearing.
He had part of a public hearing, but what purpose did it serve when the press was not notified and the public were not notified in advance that they would have access to it? This happened only when Mark Lane demanded it while he was a witness before the commission. And then he himself at one point asked that the hearing be closed again. Fewer than 1/6 of the hearings were attended by as few as a single member of the commission. Most of the testimony was taken in what I've come to call back rooms in Dallas, with a commission attorney and a stenographer and a single witness and nobody else. And this is a mechanism that not only puts a premium on temptation, but is as close to any mechanism can be to the manufacture of error and to the indulgence of weakness. One of the things that was done very dramatically during the course of the commission's work to prejudice the case against Oswald, and this was done outrageously and without limitation or inhibition, was to leak his diary. It got to be a commercially very valuable thing to those who had it. So Congressman Ford, in a way, got involved in this. And what I'm going to read from now is the 1,431st of the commission's files, excerpts of which I reproduce in facsimile on page 8 of Whitewash 2. A letter was addressed on August 26, 1964, to Mr. J. Lee Rankin, the commission's chief counsel, by Mr. Hoover, head of the FBI. referring to an allegation that Congressman Ford might in some way have been involved in the leak of this Oswald diary. And according to this letter of Mr. Hoover, Congressman Ford said, quote, he desired to unequivocally state and to furnish a signed statement if necessary that he did not leak the information in question. Congressman Ford confirmed the fact he did previously talk with representatives of Life magazine and further stated that under no circumstances had he given Life representatives any information concerning Oswald's diary.
Did Life print Oswald's diary?
One of those that did, yes. Now listen to this. Now, of course, this is all self-serving and totally without meaning. Congressman Ford could have said the same thing into the teeth of a 50-mile-an-hour gale and would have had no more meaning. I'm continuing to quote Mr. Hoover. Representatives of this bureau have not conducted interviews with any members of the President's Commission or members of your staff other than Congressman Ford regarding this matter. No further action is being taken by this bureau concerning the leaks of Oswald's diary to the Dallas Morning News and Life magazine in the absence of a specific request from you. Hmm. Oh, this is the flimsiest sham. It's the shabbiest misrepresentation of an inquiry. It's totally without meaning. What Congressman Ford had succeeded in doing is to put the imprint of FBI approval and authentication on his entirely self-serving statement, which is entirely without support of any kind. Now, I'm not suggesting that Congressman Ford leaked this diary. I have no way of knowing. But I am suggesting that this is a fraudulent procedure, because on the basis of Mr. Hoover's own information, he had nothing to form an opinion on. But because everybody in the country has so much respect for the FBI, when this was made public and it was stated and paraphrased, everybody said, well, if Mr. Hoover says so, it has to be so. But as you see, he didn't even ask the members of the staff if they'd done anything about it. And may I suggest the members of the FBI staff and the members of the Secret Service staff and the members of the Dallas Police staff and all of the many people who had and who had access to this kind of testimony. So this is a picture of the inside of how the investigation worked. Now, I begin the book with a chapter I call Scheherazade. I'm talking of Whitewash 2. I think it's an appropriate description of Marina. Marina was sweated in a subhuman way as one of the first official acts of the investigation.
Was she the first witness called by the commission?
She was a witness to nothing, but she was not only the first, she was the major, and she was the one that spent most time on the stand. She monopolized the limited time the members of the commission could give to the hearings, and she had nothing except prejudice to fill the record with, because she had seen nothing about the assassination. She qualified herself as a witness by beginning by saying she was a liar, and she satisfied the commission by saying she wouldn't lie anymore, that she'd lied in the past because she wasn't under oath. But now that she was under oath, she wouldn't tell any more lies because nothing was going to happen to her. She didn't want to get in trouble. What really happened to Marina is this, Mr. O'Connell. First, she appears to have been at the home of the chief of police. She spent the first night with the Mrs. Payne and so forth, and then Life magazine put her and Mrs. Oswald Sr. in a hotel room. And then she was at the home of the chief of police of Dallas.
Now, the Paynes, you mentioned Mrs.
Payne. Ruth Payne, with whom Mrs. Oswald Jr., Marina Oswald, lived all the time, and Lee Oswald lived on weekends. So on the morning of the day Oswald was killed, 2 days after the assassination of the president, we pick up the story. You will not find this in the report, by the way, and I have not seen it in any of the 26 vast volumes with 10 million words in them. I found it in the files. The Secret Service picked up Marina at Chief of Police Curry's home, and it's still a mysterious thing. And Mrs. Marguerite Oswald, the mother, and the Oswald infants. And the first thing they did, naturally, is take her out of Dallas, because the last thing you want is a witness at the scene of the crime. And while they were, in effect, spiriting her away with Robert Oswald, the brother of the late Lee, still in Dallas, it came over the radio that Lee Oswald had been shot. Robert heard it, and he didn't ask the permission of the Secret Service, the FBI. He took off for the hospital to see his brother. The Secret Service didn't tell either the mother or the wife that Oswald had been shot. They waited until they had them on the car out of Dallas. Now, the Secret Service reports, and I have of this a 45-page interrogation of Marina, transcribed by the Secret Service, and a large number of Secret Service reports covering this period. According to the Secret Service itself, they were out of Dallas before Agent Kunkel mentioned to the Oswald women that Lee had been shot. In his self-serving statement, and you must remember that he wasn't called before the commission, so all we have is what is not in the record, but what is in, buried in the files. And I want to point out that when it's in 300 cubic feet of documents, it certainly is buried when there is no adequate description or index. You've got to have a divining rod to get this stuff. He said that when they were out of Dallas, he told the women that Oswald had been wounded seriously, but they nonetheless wanted to go on to a town 30 miles away where they were going to have a residence temporarily. Marina, before the commission, said that when he first told her about it while they were leaving Dallas, he said that Oswald's injuries were not serious. This first mention is not referred to in the statement of the agent. Then there came over the two-way radio, and now the women were in the car where they couldn't help hearing it, you see, the statement that Oswald had been killed. And you can believe it or not, this Secret Service agent didn't conceive it to be his function and responsibility as either a Secret Service agent or a human being to get the women to Oswald's bedside. Because what he says is that they insisted, the word insisted I give you in quotes, they insisted on being taken to the hospital. Now, how subhuman can you get when you're dealing with human beings? Imagine these two women, one a mother and the other a wife, having to insist on being taken to the hospital room of their relative who had been murdered only because public authority made it possible.
Well, it's the commission's contention, largely, is it not, that Marina Oswald was incommunicado, partially at her own request, and to protect her from publicity
it's
seeking...
It's a pretense. Because everything is diametrically opposite. I'm going to come right into that right now. So before Oswald was stiff, they took these women back to Irving, Texas, and separated Marina from her mother-in-law. In fact, they separated her immediately from everybody, except a Mr. Gregory, a member of the Russian community, who acted as a translator. And there was a rather large Russian-speaking community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And as I told you before, there was a tape recording made, and the transcription of the tape recording takes up 45 pages. Now, this means a very extensive interrogation, because you realize that there had to be a double translation from English to Russian, from Russian to English, and so forth. There came a point when Marina protested that she was getting tired, and they continued nonetheless. It's too long to go into, but believe me, that Marina's first story is not her final story. Everybody will probably remember the rather dramatic figure of speech so well exploited by the commission. Ah, that fateful rifle of Lee Harvey Oswald, attributed to Marina.
This was her identification of the alleged murder weapon.
Yeah. But what actually happened is that she said at this particular time that she didn't know rifles came with telescopes, and she saw the one attributed to Oswald on television. She said that his had no telescope on it, as she called it. This is only a sample of the differences between what originally Marina said and what the commission ultimately found in her testimony. Now, she was actually held in protective custody. It is a shabby pretense to pretend that this was for her own interest. She was given to understand very explicitly that if she knew what was good for her, she would say what was expected of her. She was told that if she wanted to stay in this country, she would have to cooperate, and she was subject to deportation. I submit in the face of this, Marina should never have been called as a witness. I submit that the government, if its own integrity was of any interest to it, should have exposed this entire thing, which I have from its record and from its record alone. Marina could never have been a witness in the legal proceeding because the Fifth Amendment would have denied it. But the commission had no reluctance to deny the dead accused his rights under the Fifth Amendment, and to protect the wife with her rights under the Fifth Amendment. Instead, it made her its creature. Having been having begun by being abused by the Secret Service, Marina Oswald has now been defamed in history by the commission. Now, I don't find either Lee Harvey Oswald or Marina attractive personalities.
Well, you've already said she would not have been a trustworthy witness.
That's right, but I do say that this is a shameful way to treat any kind of a witness in any kind of a proceeding that's to be taken seriously. So this is the beginning of whitewash, too, because Marina, the first witness before the commission, she's the first chapter of my book. And some of these documents I was telling you about, this one is Secret Service Report CO-2-34030, 1124 to 1130 is the period covered, 1963, Dallas, Texas, a report of Special Agent Charles Kunkel. This is the they insisted bit and how he got the women out of Dallas and so forth. That's on page 23 of Whitewash. Next I go into the Tippit murder, and let me say briefly, but this is another pure fantasy.
Well, this is a reconstruction that I had hoped we might get to
I wasn't really going to go into that. All I was going to say was that the commission couldn't get Oswald to the scene of the crime until that 5 minutes after it was on the police radio. The commission's report is so barren on the murder of Officer Tippit that it lacks even the official certification of his death. I want the full enormity of that to sink in, because the evidence against Oswald at the book depository just didn't exist. The police made it seem as though Oswald could have been a president killer by affixing to him the label of cop killer. And everybody, policemen and others, absolutely hate, and they should hate, a man who kills a policeman, because policemen are important in our society. We require them. We can't get along without them. And we should hate a man who kills a policeman. So they fixed the label of cop killer on Oswald, knowing full well that he couldn't have done it. They couldn't get them to the scene of the crime on time.
Well, they paced off a reconstruction of their own that, according to their reasoning, permitted him to have arrived just in time to have committed
the crime. That's exactly what the report says. The report says that the commission reenacted it, and this showed that he could have done it by walking fast. But I tell you that it shows the opposite. I tell you that when this reenactment was made by the commission staff, including even its editor, by representatives of the state of Texas, by one of the commission's stable of incredible witnesses, the cab driver Whaley, that they couldn't get Oswald to the scene of the crime until more than 5 minutes after it was on the police radio. The time allowed by the commission's reconstruction to get Oswald to the scene of the crime from his rooming house, and its mythology by which they fix the time at which he left his rooming house. But even accepting that, they had less than 12 minutes. But when they reenacted it, it took them 17 minutes and 45 seconds. Now in white, so you see, they couldn't get him there until 5 minutes too late. Now in Whitewash 2, and I'm sure we won't have time to go into this, I want to tell you that I have a whole collection of Secret Service reconstructions of the same crime and the same path taken. And it bears no relationship to what the commission did.
Well, what I'm interested in knowing, is there information in the archives that is not in the report or 26 volumes that permits you a new evaluation of the Tippit reconstruction that wasn't possible before?
Several, and I was going to refer to one that I have in this chapter. There's the one I just started to refer to, the Secret Service reconstruction. Now, the Secret Service was reconstructing the same crimes with the same evidence, with watches keeping the same kind of time, and they were 5 minutes wrong in the other direction.
Well, now, you're saying that the Secret Service was conducting a reconstruction apart from other reconstructions?
Yes, indeed, right at the beginning.
Well, how many were there? How many?
God knows. God knows, but one has changed while it's being reported. The Secret Service makes a reconstruction and reports it to Inspector Kelly. Inspector Kelly reports it to the commission, and he makes changes in it. And the changes in the number of shots fired, for example.
Well, could we take the time sequence, first of all, from Oswald leaving his rooming house and lead into it that way?
Yes. Well, the Secret Service initially gave him about 10 minutes.
He left his rooming house at what time and according to what witness?
I've forgotten, but I have this set forth in intimate detail with reproductions from the Secret Service.
Well, now the commission
says too, but it was earlier than the commission says.
Well, the commission maintains that according to Earlene Roberts, who was a housekeeper, that he left, he entered the house at approximately 1 o'clock.
Yes.
Oswald entered the rooming house at approximately 1 o'clock and was in his room for a matter of 1 or 2 minutes.
Right, and then he left. Now, when the Secret Service gets to this, they give Oswald a half minute inside the house and standing in a bus stop where Mrs. Roberts saw him. Now, this is totally incredible. A half minute is no time at all. In this half minute, according to the inaccurate version of what happened, because Oswald didn't change his clothes, he changed his clothing, put on a jacket, found a pistol, stuck it in his waist, and left. All of this in a half minute, and still included time he stood in the bus stop. Now, this couldn't happen. But this is the way the Secret Service leaned over backwards to get him there to be sure he could commit the crime. It was too thin for the commission to do it in their reenactment. And when they tried to do something that would withstand examination and cannot, they couldn't get Oswald to the scene of the crime until 5 minutes after it was over.
Well, now, according to Mrs. Helen Markham in an affidavit that she executed either on the day of the assassination, or perhaps you'll correct me, immediately after, she maintained, or she specified, that the time of the shooting was 1:10 p.m.
I beg your pardon,
1:06.
Yes.
And then there was another witness, T.F. Bowley, who said, I looked at my watch and it was 1:10 p.m.
Yes,
but yet the commission maintains that Oswald was shot at approximately 1:16, am I correct?
Before 1:16, because it was on the police radio about 1:15.
I see.
And let's hope that the murder had been committed before it was reported. But I tell you, from some of the reconstructions, it wasn't so. It's an absolutely unbelievable story. Some of the reconstructions have the murder broadcast before it was committed. Now, I know this is just error, but this gives you an idea of the manner in which the murder of the president was investigated.
Yes, well,
because the Tippit murder is part of the story of the murder of the president.
That leads one to the question, then, with the release of this
crime.
Excuse me, Shirley.
There's not a question here of release, Mr. O'Connell. There's a question of access. But a lot of people misunderstand this. I'm not implying you do, but I think that I'd like to make specific what has happened. It is just that people may go there and see it. But the government does not turn out releases on this, does not make copies and broadcast them. They've just opened up an archive that people can go into, and it refers to some of the material only, most of it.
Yes, but I'm sure that their contention is that they have examined this evidence and found it wanting or inaccurate,
yes,
and have come to a final reconstruction that makes a judgment on this material. So,
and
so
it's equally inaccurate. It's totally impossible. Now, the key to the whole thing is, of course, the killing of the policeman Tippit. He was, after all, killed. And he wasn't killed by a pistol, he was killed by bullets. It's a strange thing, but you can get almost any number of bullets you want fired at Tippit, and almost any number of bullets in his body. He was dead. He had an autopsy. He was in one hospital, Methodist Hospital, before he was taken to Parkland for his autopsy. You remember I told you that the report's so barren it doesn't even have the certification that he's dead. Not because the commission didn't have it. I have it. In 10 million words, in 26 big volumes, with all sorts of stuff of dubious taste, like, to me, tawdry pictures of ruby strippers, page after page after page of them, there was no room for the autopsy of the policeman Tippit. There's good reason for it. Because it, too, destroys everything on it, destroys the commissioner's story. The Secret Service began by saying two shots had been fired by Tippit, but everybody knew better. So Inspector Kelly increased this to three when he reported it to the commission.
Now, who was Inspector Kelly?
He's the chief Secret Service inspector involved, to whom I referred before in the time reconstruction. Thomas Kelly. May I, in an aside, give you an idea of the kind of thing that still kept secrets? Inspector
Surely.
Kelly reminds me of it. Marina Oswald's hotel bill when she testified before the commission is classified secret.
Why is that?
I can't tell you why, but I can tell you this, that her room was reserved in the name of Tom Kelly. This is what reminded me of it. Now, I'm not suggesting any hijinks. I don't think there was anything improper, between Mr. Kelly and Mrs. Oswald. I think that this may be perhaps the normal kind of a police indirection. But I do suggest that there is absolutely no reason for keeping this secret, and that the only impropriety is suggested by the secrecy. But in any event, Inspector Kelly told the commission there were 3 bullets fired. Now, the commission itself says 4 were, but it also implies that 5 might have been. We go from 2 to 5, and I think if we looked far enough, we could probably escalate a little bit more. Now, if you're going to believe the autopsy report, all of it's wrong.
No, with reference to the, you're speaking
Tippett of murder.
The Tippett murder.
Now, the commission had to suggest 5, Mr. O'Connell, because they do have bullets and they do have empty shells. Whoever killed Tippett, and it certainly wasn't Oswald, went out of his way to be certain that he left evidence at the scene of the crime. It was like a daisy dance.
Shell
he took
casings
bullets,
were recovered
he
by
took
a
them
number
out,
of people.
Plunk, plunk, he dropped them very ostentatiously at the scene of the crime. Even an insane killer wouldn't do that. This man was leaving the evidence behind. I mean, it was like a scavenger hunt. He was leaving clues all along. So the bullets, the recovered bullets actually used, and the shells found at the scene of the crime don't match each other. In order to account for all the bullets that were, all the shells that were found, the commission had to project the hypothesis that a 5th bullet was fired and wasn't recovered because it didn't hit Tippett.
Well, what were the shells actually recovered, and what
it's
were
a question
the
of manufacture. I'm not quite certain on this. I think it was Western and Winchester, and that the shells at the scene were 2 and 2, or Peters was one of the
manufacturers. There was Remington Peters.
Remington Peters, yes. The shells were 2 of one manufacturer and 2 of another. The bullets were 3 of one manufacturer and 1 of another. Now, with only 1 bullet to account for 2 shells, they had to project the 2nd bullet of the 2nd manufacturer so that each of the shells would have been filled up.
Does the commission explain this discrepancy in their report?
No, it doesn't. It cannot. There is no way of explaining it because it's pure hypothesis. So we've got Tippett. He's without doubt dead. And without doubt, he was killed with bullets. So we have a belated, and it was very belated. It took over 2 weeks to prepare the autopsy. Now, Oswald's autopsy is different than the president's and different than Tippett's, because while the president got an autopsy unworthy of a Bowery bum, leaving behind nothing but question, conjecture, all sorts of inferences, and Tippett's was delayed, and it's in the same kind of limbo, Oswald's is a modernist scientific precision, in which everything is located with great precision from inflexible points of the body, with even such things as minute as an abrasion of 1/16th of an inch indicated and precisely and unequivocally located. So poor Tippett is dead, and he's got an autopsy. And the Secret Service tries for a while and doesn't get it, and then finally a couple weeks after the murder they get it. Now, if we're to believe Dr. Rose, who performed the autopsy, the only fair way to say what happened to Tippett is to say that he was hit by 3.5 bullets. The reason I say a half is because although the commission says 4 bullets were taken from Tippett's body, Dr. Rose says to the contrary, that a 4th bullet struck a button of Tippett's uniform and did not enter the body, but that Tippett sustained a bruise from the button. You begin to understand why this stuff was not in the record, why in 10 million words they couldn't have it in. So this is part of my chapter in Whitewash 2 on the Tippett murder. And I should explain that in the first part of the book's divided into 3 parts, as is Whitewash 1. I take up some of these elements of evidence that the commission should never have left unanswered, and could have answered. Now, the next chapter is called The Curry Phone. You may remember the Chief of Police Curry.
Are we leaving the Tippett?
Yes.
We're leaving Tippett. Before we get to Curry, there are a couple of things in Whitewash, too, that I think are of prime importance, and I wanted to
Let's go to
address those before we run out of time. You reproduce the version, the fullest version that I have seen of a photograph taken by Ike Alkins, the Associated Press photographer in Dallas on the day of the assassination. And I wonder if you would relate to us the contents of that chapter, which I found fascinating, with reference to a man in the doorway bearing a resemblance to Oswald, and what you have adduced about that man that hasn't been dealt with in a number of the other books.
You're right in describing that picture, but in Whitewash 2, I have the full unretouched, the total negative. Now, Wesley Liebler, one of the more active and more important assistant counsels, handled all of the photographic evidence, and that includes Mr. Altkins, who was one of the witnesses. Mr. Liebler found it expedient to get none of the essential information into the record. This includes the identification of the camera, the kind of film that was used, the kind of lens that was used, and in a rather abnormal departure from good and required practice, he didn't even ask Altkins to produce his picture or the negative of his picture so they could establish that it hadn't been touched up or anything like that. The motion picture taken by Abraham Zapruder is, in my opinion, the most important single bit of evidence, but I believe the most important single picture is that of James W. Altkins, which in itself is utterly and totally destructive of the report.
Now, you contend that that picture, on the basis of your analysis of the picture from blow-ups, and on the basis of the clothing worn by a figure in the doorway, and also on the basis of your analysis of correspondence between J. Edgar Hoover and Chief Counsel Rankin, the thrust of your chapter, it seems to me, leaves one with the clear feeling that the man standing in the doorway of the depository at the time of the assassination was indeed Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
Is that a fair...
Absolutely. And the meaning of that very clearly is this, because this picture was taken, according to the FBI, and they're quite right, at a point that coincides with the 255th frame of the Zapruder film.
Now, will you tell us...
what a frame is?
How one... No, yes. We've discussed the Zapruder film, but in terms of alignment and how the commission determined where the Altkins picture was in relation to the Zapruder film.
Lyndall Cheney felt, the FBI's photographic expert, who was the same thing for the commission, proved by the internal evidence of the Zapruder frame, 255, and the internal evidence of the Altkins picture that they exactly coincide.
Well, does Altkins appear in Zapruder frame 255?
No, but Altkins appears much later in the Zapruder film at a part the commission elected not to reproduce. Thus, we are denied a precise positioning of Altkins at the time he took his picture. It wasn't because they didn't have the evidence, it was just because they denied it to us.
Well, they said it wasn't that important to determine precisely where he was standing, did they
that
not?
Came out when Altkins was disputed by Wesley Liebler in his testimony, and Altkins challenged Liebler to a reconstruction, and Mr. Liebler, who is normally a fluent and eloquent man, found himself almost incoherent when confronted with that challenge, and he said, well, it isn't at all that important, and he passed on to something else. But the truth is that this picture was taken about halfway through the assassination, and it must be obvious that Oswald could not have been on the first floor observing an assassination he was simultaneously committing from the sixth. This picture has any number of things, but let's begin with that one thing. There's the figure of a man leaning up against and twisting himself to his left around the western end of the doorway. He is wearing a shirt that has a dark body and a pale fleck in the picture going through it.
In the texture of the shirt itself.
Yeah. Oh yes, it's unmistakable.
Fabric of the shirt.
It's a long sleeve shirt. It's November 22nd, but the shirt is open at the top. And there are, in enlargement, you can see a little bit of an unusual shape as though something has been pulled there. Now, Oswald was arrested and he was photographed. He was photographed in the police station, in the elevator, and coming out with his hands handcuffed. That picture is exhibit, these two pictures are exhibits 1796 and 1797 in the commission's record. But they are at no point printed adjacent to the picture I've just been telling you about, this part of the Altkins picture. Now, Mr. Schoenfeld took part of the picture of Oswald when he was arrested. And here, if I may have an aside, the FBI had a tremendous compulsion to decapitate Oswald photographically. Although Oswald certainly had his head in Exhibit 1797, he does not have it in the enlargement of 1797 made by Schoenfeld and introduced into evidence as Schoenfeld Exhibit 24A, which I reproduce on the inside back cover. I should tell the listeners that all of these pictures are reproduced in the book so they can see for themselves what I'm talking about. Cheney felt 24A, the exhibit, with certain identification points, two of which, numbers 5 and 6, show buttons missing.
This is a picture of Oswald after he had been arrested.
With everything except his head. They got the tip of his chin, and they don't even have his mouth. Oswald's head's not on it. Thus, of course, we obviously lose points of identification in his face, in his hairline. We have to presume this is an accident, just as we have to presume that when Cheneyfelt was making a duplicate of a picture of Oswald holding a rifle, which, when published, had the shadow of his nose going in one direction and the shadow of his body going in another, he selected from the thousands of employees of the FBI working underneath the roof on which he took the picture only one man whose face, he said, might not be shown in public. So that picture is decapitated, too. Now, the Cheneyfelt Exhibit 24A shows buttons missing at exactly the same point at which the shirt of the man in the doorway is open. It shows a pattern which is remarkably like that of the man in the doorway. The commission through the FBI was told that another man, not Oswald, was this man in the doorway, another employee whose name is Billy Nolan Lovelady. And there was a lot of hedging and fudging on this, but the commission's hand was forced by people asking questions about the picture of the man in the doorway, and they directed Mr. Hoover to conduct an inquiry. Mr. Hoover reported to the commission. This is the 457th of the commission's files, and I have an exact copy of it, a copy of the picture that was included. I'd like to read to you part of what Mr. Hoover told the commission in his report. Now, this is the bottom of the fourth page of the report and the top of the fifth, but I've excerpted it. He said that on February 29, 1964, Billy Nolan Lovelady was photographed by special agents of the FBI at Dallas, Texas. On this occasion, Lovelady advised that on the day of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, November 22, 1963, at the time of the assassination, he was standing in the doorway at the front entrance of the Texas School Book Depository building where he is employed. He stated he was wearing a red and white vertical striped shirt and blue jeans, close quote. Now, the shirt on the man in the doorway is clearly not a striped one. To make this overwhelming, I reproduced two of the three pictures that the FBI gave the commission in a single print of Lovelady, pictures taken by the FBI. They were very careful to let Lovelady get a 5 o'clock shadow, and remember, Oswald had overslept his rendezvous with Destiny and hadn't been able to shave. This is a heavy shadow on the face of the man in the doorway.
They're attempting to duplicate now the photograph of Ike Altgens by...
But of course, they're having to presume certain things that they can't tell from a picture. They knew that Oswald hadn't shaved, so they let Lovelady's beard grow. Then they posed him so that in using lights, they accented this with shadows on the various pictures of Lovelady taken. They leave Lovelady's shirt unbuttoned, although the buttons are clearly reflective and visible. Lovelady's looks like a brand new shirt. They leave it open, coinciding exactly with the opening in Oswald's shirt in Cheneyfelt Exhibit 24A. The man in the doorway, who I believe was Oswald, had a long sleeve shirt. Lovelady's is a short sleeve shirt. But above all, the shirt that Lovelady is wearing in this official FBI picture has the very broadest stripe I have ever seen on any garment in my life. It must be broader than 2 inches, with ample white space in between the red stripes.
You're fair to the testimony of Lovelady because you reproduce it in whitewash, too. And as I recall, he said that the FBI was relieved when I told them that I was the man in the photograph.
Right.
Well, is it your opinion that Lovelady was mistaken or that he was purposely perjuring himself?
Why Lovelady said what he did, only Lovelady can answer. But there's one thing that there cannot be in dispute, and that is that the FBI establishes that the shirt that Lovelady was wearing that day rules him out as the man standing in the doorway.
And now, do we know the type of shirt, its fabric, its texture, its color, that Oswald was wearing in the depository that morning?
No, they have, that's very carefully avoided in the testimony. We have only the picture of the man in the doorway who looks so much like Oswald, and incidentally so does Lovelady. But we have Oswald in the shirt in which he was arrested that day. And that shirt is remarkably like the shirt on the man in the doorway.
And yet we were told that Mrs. Payne, I beg your pardon, that Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper at Oswald's residence in Dallas, that he had changed jackets, or that he had...
The jacket, that's right, but the non-existent...
When he came in from the depository.
Yes, he put on a pale jacket.
Yes.
But the non-existent police interrogations, which are represented in various incredible ways, none of them is an interrogation report, quote Oswald as having said he changed his shirt. There's no evidence that he did at all. Now, there are many other things bearing on this, but the thing that's clear is, and all of it bears one way, by the way, Oswald is supposed to have told the police things that happened on the first floor that he could have known only had he been there. He could not have been on the sixth floor and reported what was going on the first floor, people he saw walking through and so forth. Now, I've recently discovered in some of these previously secret documents that the FBI was told by employees of the depository that they were, in fact, on the first floor and think they saw Oswald at that time. It's not in the report. It's not in the 26 volumes, but it's in the files. I think it's inevitable that we have to conclude on the basis of all of this that the man in the doorway actually was Oswald. There's one thing that is overwhelmingly clear. It cannot possibly have been Lovelady. Now, there's something even more important from my point of view in this picture. When I say from my point of view, I never set out to prove that Oswald was innocent. This is a byproduct of my researches. I set out because I wasn't satisfied that we'd been told the total truth. I wasn't satisfied the commission had done its job. The most important thing about the Altkins picture is that it unmistakably and irrefutably places the president's car at the 255th frame
of the Zapruder film.
This means that working backward by the speed of a camera, the position of the president's car at every tiny fragment of a second was irrefutably known. Now, the commission was told by the FBI that Zapruder's camera exposed film at the rate of 18.3 frames a second. For the benefit of listeners who have no movie cameras, normal speed is 16 frames a second, and because these are not precision instruments, there is a variation. Now, at no point in the entire 10 million words and all the countless thousands of pages, there must be way over 10,000 pages of evidence that the commission prints, because the 26 volumes and the smallest ones have over 500 pages and the largest ones have about 1,000. At no point will you find the entire Altkins picture. When Mr. Liebler was examining Altkins and he introduced into evidence what he said was Altkins' picture, he gave Altkins Exhibit 203, which is only a small part of that picture. It's considerably less than half. I don't believe at any point the commission ever saw half of the picture. And this is why I tried for a year, and finally the Associated Press found the original negative after they said it couldn't be found, and they now, I am happy to say, have listened to me, and they have it under lock and key in New York because they recognize it as a very important national document.
Well, what was missing from the picture, is that crucial to determine the speed of the limousine or its placement
location,
on the road?
Its location, yes. Because it is very clear, this is a remarkably clear picture for one taken in such a hurry. It was taken with a Nikorex camera. Mr. Liebler didn't want the world to know, so I'll tell them. A Nikorex camera, 105mm lens, Tri-X film. Now, the president's car has just approached the fourth of the visible dividing broken stripes that line the road into lanes.
This is on Elm Street.
On Elm Street, as it was going west and past the depository entrance. The president had not yet reached that point. This means that entirely aside from reconstructing the crime by going forward and backward, we know where the president was, first at the 255th frame, and we know where he was in the Zapruder film when he was approaching the fourth road stripe. Now, this same photographic expert, Mr. Lyndall Schoenfeld, was in charge of a photographic reenactment of the crime in Dallas on May 24, 1963, when they got Zapruder's camera back from Bell and Howell. Imagine that this camera was not in the government's possession. Lyndall Schoenfeld represented the results of the photographic reenactment, in which they used limousines and stand-ins for the various people and all that sort of thing. In the chart, Shaney Felt, Exhibit 25, this is the basic information given to the commission. I tell you because I have finally held the original in my hand. It's illegible even in the original. This is the kind of stuff the commission was given
to. I'm sorry, that it is illegible?
Absolutely. Illegible in the hands without a magnifying lens to read the stuff he's put on it. But one thing is very clear, and that's the position of the president's car at a certain time. Now, all the reconstructions by the government clearly prove that Oswald or anybody else in the sixth-floor window could not have shot the president and hit him before the 210th frame, because there was what is called a live oak tree between the sixth-floor window and the presidential car. So the official story is that at or immediately after frame 210, the president was shot for the first time. Now, Mr. Shaney Felt told the commission where the president's car was at frame 210. And I have it on page 246 of whitewash 2 from the original document, and in whitewash 1 I have it reproduced from the printed record of the commission. They are, of course, identical. Shaney Felt said that at frame 210, the president was just approaching the same fourth road stripe that we know he was at frame 255.
So, in other words, when the president was first hit, he was not visible to
not
any
assassin.
He was not
That's
accessible
right.
to any assassin in the sixth floor window.
That's right. And further than that, it means that the FBI has misrepresented the entire thing to the commission. The president was 2 to 3 seconds ahead of where, I'm sorry, behind, ahead in the shooting schedule, but behind in reality, where he was represented to have been. There's a 45-frame difference at the fourth road stripe. We know it's frame 255, not 210. So you have to move the president backward in the Altkins picture for 45 frames, or for almost 3 seconds, according to the official reconstruction. Now, I want to tell you also that this reconstruction is false in an additional way, and it was only 2 seconds, because it is pure hokum that Zapruder's camera was exposing film at 18 frames per second. I discovered this in Shaney Felt's testimony when he was informing the commission, supposedly. He said that during the reenactment where they used Zapruder's film and had everything faithfully duplicated, the actual time represented by what they filmed, which was a reproduction of the 222nd through the 313th frame of the Zapruder film, took 3.5 seconds. However, in the actual Zapruder film of the actual assassination, the same sequence took 5 seconds. Shaney Felt just blandly told the commission it didn't quite work out. And for their information, he had put orange spots on the film so they would know where things that were not were supposed to be. Now, this is incredible. The FBI engages in a reconstruction of the assassination of a president with a knowing 30% error? Well, the answer is very simple if you have a motion picture camera. The camera was set at a different speed. Most cameras have slow, normal, and fast speeds. Most cameras, and specifically this camera, at fast speed go 24 frames per second. The difference between the actual film and the reconstruction is exactly that difference between 18 frames a second and 24. Now, bearing on this, in my most recent ransacking of the commission's files, I have found the report of FBI agent Barrett of his interrogation of the 4th of December, 1963, 2 weeks after the assassination of Abraham Zapruder. He dictated his report that day, and he filed it on that day, and I reproduce it in facsimile in whitewash, too. And Zapruder told the FBI that his camera was set at 24 frames a second. Despite this, the FBI engaged in a reenactment of an assassination of a president and told the commission and made the reenactment based on a knowingly wrong figure and a knowingly wrong speed of 18 frames a second.
Then from this can we conclude that the span of shots, the time span, is somewhat less than the commission says?
One-third less.
So
now,
how many seconds then do we have to account for all the shots that were fired?
Approximately 3.5 seconds, perhaps just a shade more, but certainly less than 4 seconds.
Well, isn't that in contradiction to most of the ear witness testimony at the time of the assassination?
No, it is to some and it is not to others. But when you're going to ask people how much of a fraction of a second is when they're not sitting with a clock and not expecting to report, you don't want to pay any attention to what they say. Because with the best intentions of the world, they're not capable of telling you what really happened. It's too small a time.
Well, are you saying then that the commission overlooked this statement by Barrett, or it was uninformed?
It didn't know it.
It did not know it.
No, what I am saying is that the members of the commission had no way of knowing what I'm just telling you.
Barrett's affidavit was never examined by members of the commission or the commission staff?
There's no evidence that it was. Now, the commission staff is another matter. I cannot imagine it being in the files without the staff being aware of it. But I cannot imagine the members of the commission having seen it. It's not in the report. It's not in the appended 26 volumes. Now, we have to go one step farther from this. The Oswald rifle, or the rifle attributed to Oswald, not in the hands of a duffer like Oswald, but in the hands of the most skilled men in the world, and presuming it worked perfectly, which it didn't in practice, it had a tendency for the bolt to stick. To just put another bullet in the chamber required a minimum of 2.3 seconds. Now, if it had to be reloaded twice, the mere operation of reloading required 4.6 seconds. You have to add to this the time of sighting, and you have to add to that total the time of squeezing, because you know you can't jerk a trigger. Now, this obviously could not have been accomplished in 4 seconds. So here we have three proofs all at one point that Oswald could not have been the assassin, that the assassination could not have been committed in the sixth-floor window, and thus the total destruction of the entire report. And all of it based upon information available to the government, in the government's possession from which I got it, and to the best of my knowledge, denied the members of the commission, who were thus put in the position of having signed what amounts to a fraudulent report, contrary to the knowledge that should have been given to it.
Thank you, Mr. Weisberg. We've been talking again to Mr. Harold Weisberg, newspaper and magazine writer from Hyattstown, Maryland, former Senate investigator and an intelligence and political analyst. Mr. Weisberg is the author of two books on the assassination, Whitewash and Whitewash II, the latter we've subtitled The FBI Secret Service Cover-Up. I want to thank you again for coming back to our studio, Mr. Weisberg.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad to be here.
The interviewer was William O'Connell, the project coordinator on the material and personnel related to the Warren Commission report on the assassination of the late President Kennedy. Mr. O'Connell is an actor by profession with an active interest in pursuing his own study on the reports. The program was recorded and it came to us from KPFK, the Pacifica station in Southern California. And these are the Pacifica stations in Berkeley, KPFA and KPFB.